Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. Certainly today is no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Georgia Dow, who is a very busy psychotherapist, writer, speaker, and hosts, I lost count of the number of podcasts. Georgia Dow, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
How many podcasts are you hosting? Is it like 40 or 90 or something?
I think regularly it's about 5. I do some guest hosting on some different variety of podcasts as well. Some of them were based on technology and some of them were based on psychology.
So you are a very busy individual.
A little bit busy, yeah.
Yes. And actually, you are working with the Montreal Center for Anxiety and Depression. And today what we're going to talk about in large measure is the work that you do in treating folks with anxiety.
Yes.
So let's start with exactly what anxiety is. I mean, it's defined as one of the most common mental illnesses in America. I know you're in Canada. I'm not sure what the numbers are like in Canada, but certainly in America, the information that I have is that there are 40 million adults who are having this experience. So what is it that at least 40 million people in the world are going through?
Well, anxiety, it's like our body's natural alarm clock. So we have this part of our body that helps us protect from whatever dangers we might foresee. And so what it is it's the fear of fear, really. It's our body saying, I need to go into fight or flight. Sometimes we freeze in order to keep you safe. And so though this is something that's very beneficial, and a long time ago, we needed to have this anxiety system to keep us out of danger. Right now, our world is quite safe, but this part of our body wants to make sure to find the next biggest fear. And unfortunately, if we keep self-perpetuating our thought processes about, oh, I'm worried about this and what about that, we can end up having an anxiety system that would be higher than what the level of danger is in our world. And then once the alarm system has been kind of preset to be really high, that part of our brain becomes really, really strong. And it will be almost like a trigger effect that it will go off very quickly. And we'll end up having anxiety that will be outside the range of what is comfortable or what is warranted for our society right now.
Well, there are lots of people listening who are saying, well, I get anxious. You know, I'm worried about paying a bill or getting to work or school on time. I'm worried about a project deliverable. Is there a difference between levels of anxiety or no?
Yes, it definitely is. Having anxiety is perfectly normal and healthy and good for us. Having anxiety, an anxiety system that you can't turn off, that seems to be on all the time, or for something that you would foresee and know that this is really dangerous, but you can't stop worrying about it. When it starts affecting your day-to-day life and you can't do the things that you enjoy doing, that's when you probably are dealing with an anxiety issue where you might want to get it taken care of. Because the wonderful thing is that anxiety with treatment always gets better. It just does. This is an area of psychology that we have a lot of understanding of, and really we understand how to treat this. And if you don't treat it, unfortunately, anxiety often gets worse and can get worse really quickly on its own. So if you have anxiety because of a test or a bill, and then later when the bill is paid or if the test is done, you feel fine, great. But if you're worrying about bills that haven't even come in yet, if you're worrying about a test that's 4 weeks away and you can't read, you can't sleep, you can't eat, now it's affecting your day-to-day life. And that's really damaging to us. because we need to be able to turn off the system as well. And unfortunately, sometimes it gets turned on and our body says, this is really helpful to keep us alive, but actually it's doing more damage than good.
Well, you've just said that there are a number of ways, very successful ways of treating anxiety disorders. My understanding, though, is that only about a third of the people who actually experience the kind of anxiety you're discussing actually get treatment. What's your sense of what keeps people out of treatment for something that is so treatable?
I think the one is that though wonderful shows like yours are helping to talk about this and normalize what are different issues that people go through, I think that there's still a stigma. And so I think that a lot of people say that if they don't say or admit that they're dealing with this, then they don't have to worry that they have that. I think that they're worried about judgment. I think that they're worried about other people finding out about this and that they might, you know, lose work or they might be not be able to deal with their health care. And then I think that often therapists get a bad rap. I think that people are worried about going in. What if we're judgmental? What if we're harsh? What if this is not going to work out or it's an uncomfortable feeling? And these are personal issues that they may not feel like sharing with someone that they do not know yet. And so a lot of people try to deal with it on their own. And some people are able to, which is wonderful. The problem is that what if you can't and you haven't told anyone and you're just suffering in silence? And that is a reason I think that a lot of people don't come in, don't get treatment, and don't really want to look at it. We like to look at the stuff that we're good at, but it's hard to look at the stuff that are issues that we need to treat or deal with differently.
Well, that's true. I mean, it can feel pretty anxiety provoking to look at those parts of oneself that you yourself are judging.
Oh, yes. I think that even myself as a therapist, I've had to look at all kinds of things about myself. And I'm like, oh, that's not comfortable. I fully understand why people might not want to go in to take a look at that. The wonderful thing is that, you know, we're all like puzzles, right? If you want to fix a puzzle, you have to look at all the pieces and understand how they fit together. Once you do that, then you're not going to fall into the traps that we often fall into because you're not paying attention or you don't know that. Once you know yourself really well, then that helps you be able to change and live a better life and be able to reach your dreams. And you're not going to have these things stopping you because you understand, oh, you know what? I'm usually late. I'm going to make sure I get up an extra 30 minutes early because this interview is really important to me. Or I have a fear of public speaking. So you know what? I'm going to practice and work on this. So this isn't going to hold me back in my career.
So a lot of, it sounds like what you're saying is that a lot of anxiety is grown, if you will, by the nature of your self-talk.
Definitely. Definitely a lot of the way that we speak to ourselves can either help calm us down or can help increase our feelings of fear and distress. So if you look at the way that you speak to yourself, a lot of people that might be leaning towards being type A personalities, so I'm a type A personality. Pamela, you're probably also a type A personality, hardworking, achievement-oriented, care a lot about things, but also hold yourself to a high measure and you're hard on yourself. And the problem with that is that you can also have a lot of critical negative thoughts and being hard when you should be kind. And when you make a mistake, you're noticing the mistake instead of the good parts to it as well. And if we can work on the way that we speak to ourselves, we can calm ourselves down instead of, oh my goodness, I can't do this. This is dangerous. What about this? What if statements? We say, you know what? This is okay. We can do this. I've handled this before. It's okay to make mistakes. I'll learn from it and pick up the pieces. Those two systems are completely different. And if you're a really good coach to yourself, you help calm yourself down and make yourself feel more happy and more secure and increase your esteem. And that's really helpful in times of danger or in fear.
So in fact, if you are, if you feel as though you fall into the experience that you described a few minutes ago of those who are sort of chronically, constantly worrying about one thing or another, you actually could theoretically do some work for yourself with yourself. You can certainly go work with a therapist, but you could also do some work for and with you.
Yes. Definitely you can. And I love to ask people to just journal it. Journal is a way that you speak to yourself and take a look at it. Often we'll be shocked by how harsh or cruel or critical or negative that we can be. And it almost like runs like a record in the background, and we're not even aware that we're doing this to ourselves. But if you think, you know, would I say this to my friend or my child or my loved one? If you say no way I would ever speak to someone else that I care about that way, then you shouldn't be speaking to yourself that way either. And if you track it and call yourself out on it when you do it and say, am I really being hard on myself, too hard on myself, too negative, and work on what would be a positive way to say this? Or if this had happened to someone that I care about, what would I say to them? That's honest, but still, you know, supportive and helps pick you up. That does a world of good. And really, if you do that every day, in about 6 weeks, you can notice that you are becoming more positive, more calm, and happier.
In just 6 weeks, if you do something like this on a consistent basis.
Yes. If you're doing about 15 to 30 minutes of work on either writing it down or really paying attention, being really conscious to it, it's wonderful, because what we're dealing about is learning, right? So the more that you practice something, the better you get at it. So neurons that fire together will wire together. And the wonderful thing about neuroplasticity is whatever you do every day, you're going to get better at. And so if you've been practicing being anxious, you're getting better at being anxious, because that's what you're doing every day. If you're working on being positive and supportive and caring, you're actually also going to get better at that. That part of your brain becomes stronger, because those neurons are going to fire in a pattern together, and they'll wire more in a pattern together, which is wonderful news. That means that we have a certain amount of control on who we want to be. It's no longer that old thought of, you know what, that's who I am and I can't change that. We know that that's not true. You can learn something if you practice it. So if you practice about 15 to 30 minutes a day of being really positive and supportive, and then slowly try to increase that number, your neurons, we believe, grow at about like 0.03 millimeters a day. So it's not a lot, but for the brain, that's huge. And slowly those neurons will start forming pathways together. And then you'll start feeling, oh my goodness, I'm noticing how cool I am to myself. At first it feels worse, because you're noticing how cruel and negative you are. And that's kind of a hard hit, because before it ran in the background unconsciously. Once you start noticing it, though, you can start changing it. And then when you start changing it, it feels good. And then after a while, you might start to spontaneously be more positive. And so, yes, if you work on it from my sessions, it's about, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And then people start feeling, you know what? I notice that I'm so mean to myself. And then they say, you know what, I, you know, did something wrong. And then I said, it's okay. I can do this. It's okay.
Well, that's pretty encouraging. Now, you used a word that some people may not be familiar with, which is neuroplasticity. So can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what that means?
Yes, definitely. So neuroplasticity is a theory that we used to believe that for certain parts of our brain really didn't change much, that they were really hard. And now we've learned that our brain is much more plastic, much more moldable than that. And so if there's, what happens is that neurons can connect to each other, and that's what learning is. And synapses can touch one another. And that's what we do for when we're learning a new skill. It often feels uncomfortable at the beginning, and then after a while you do it, it just kind of clicks. And those are synapses reaching out to other synapses and talking to one another. And so what you do is, if you stop doing something, you stop playing piano, and you used to be a concert pianist, you'll notice that you're not as good at piano that you used to be, because those synapses slowly get pruned, because they're no longer needed. Your brain is highly resourceful. And so the areas of your brain that you use more, you're going to spend more resources in. And so you're actually encouraging your brain to get stronger in the areas that you practice, and slowly those synapses won't in areas that you don't practice. So you have a lot of power in who you become going forward. And I'm not saying that it's easy. It's a little bit of work. You have to spend the time to it. But, you know, if you want to spend the time of working out and exercising and trying to eat healthy, well, this is just along the lines of that, but just making sure that your brain is really good to you. Because think about how your world would change if the only thing that was different was that you were positive and supportive to yourself. What would that world be like for you?
And I would suspect that for many people, the world would be entirely different.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Much more different. Just the way that we interpret the world, it's almost like the way that we think of the world is our filter that we see the world through. So you have the choice of putting on any filter that you want. And often people say, well, you know what, I'm not negative, I'm just really realistic. And unfortunately, we usually use the word that I'm being realistic or I'm being honest as a word for like being cruel.
Yes.
And you can still be, you can still be honest, yet positive and supportive at the same time. If you're a prize fighter and you're in the ring and you're doing really well, no one should say anything to you. Just keep it up. Keep doing what you're doing. When you need to be a good coach is when the chips are down, when you're having a hard time, when you're struggling. And often that's when we're most cruel to ourselves, is when we need to be most positive. You know, you take the set of a little boy or a little girl who's playing t-ball for the first time, and everyone else goes out there and they hit the ball. And this little boy or little girl misses, and they just can't hit it. And they come to you with tears down their face. Would you look at them and say, wow, what's wrong with you? You did so horribly. Everyone else hit it and you couldn't. What's going to happen to that child? Are they ever going to play t-ball again? How are they going to feel about themselves?
Right.
You know, and most people would say, I would never do that. I would never do that to them. That would crush them. Well, then what are you doing to you? It's the same thing. And so often we're actually holding ourselves back. We're defeating ourselves before we ever hit the plate because of what we're saying to ourselves. And so it's so vastly important. People often say that, you know, sticks and stones break my bones, but words don't matter. They matter. They really do.
And, you know, that's such an old childhood saying, but we still hear that in today's world in many different ways. And so when a child or even an adult reaches out for support, there are still those people who will quote that old saying in some variation, which, of course, you know, really takes away from the individual's ability to heal, to think a different mm-hmm. way, to do any of those things that allow that person to move forward with, you know, this old childhood saying that's actually not.
Oh, Pamela, that's so beautifully, beautifully said. It's so true. And we need to change that mindset. Unfortunately, we often, you know, parent the way that our parents parented to us. And so sometimes you can hear something come out of your mouth and you're like, oh, that isn't there. But also a lot of people still believe this. We are only now understanding how our emotional health is so linked to our physical health. And so we really do need to be conscious and validating on what other people's viewpoints are. They don't have to be your viewpoints, but they should still be understood and cared about and be worthy. And it does matter, and it hurts very much. Most of my painful childhood memories are not getting beaten up in the playground, but feeling excluded or not cared about or invisible or that I didn't fit in. Those were much more painful than any of the physical altercations that I've ever been in my life. And that's what we remember, and that's what people often bring in to my sessions, are the words and the feelings that they had because of those. We don't even remember what people say to us. We just remember how they made us feel. And so if that leaves us feeling not good enough or not accepted, it's highly damaging to us as a system. Because we were like, you know, defenseless mammals. We needed the group to survive. The reason that we have social anxiety, which is the fear of judgment of others, is because of that strong need to have a group that we're a part of. And so social anxiety is that feeling of worrying about being judged by others and not being included or good enough to fit into that. And that's also very, very debilitating. And that's only linked to the way that other people make us feel.
One of the things that your comments bring up, I think, is how important it is for parents, certainly, to be mindful of the way in which they talk to their children. So many times we hear parents saying, oh, well, he was just, you know, X years old, they won't remember, or she was just a little girl, it doesn't really matter. And in fact, what you are clearly saying to us is that those things matter. They can be changed. Your reaction to it can be changed, but the existence of those kinds of experiences matter a great deal. Georgia Dow, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear about some of the things that you share with your clients who do choose to do some work on their own. Folks,
wonderful.
This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Georgia, you have been, as I indicated earlier, a psychotherapist with the Montreal Center for Anxiety and Depression for over 20 years. So my question to you is whether or not you see any gender differences in the people who report having anxiety, the people who seek treatment for having anxiety, or is it pretty much gender neutral?
There are definitely some differences. The way that we express our emotions are definitely different, whereas women will be more inclined to feel sad, upset, hurt, cry. Men lean more towards being more aggressive, more upset, or withdrawn. And so the way that we express anxiety and depression is actually quite different. A lot of men come in with a feeling of either passive aggressivity or aggression, because that's the way that they feel more comfortable. Our society still has gender differences in the way that we raise our children. So for women, it's okay to be sad, but it's not okay to be angry or aggressive. That causes a lot of negative undertones. For men, it's not seen as you're being weak if you're sad or upset and expressing that, but it's okay to be angry or withdrawn. And we need to change these gender differences in the way that we raise our children, because all of our emotions are important and we should feel comfortable with expressing them. But definitely what you might see between men and women will be very, very different. And that's why a lot of men don't come in until their anxiety or depression becomes really, really strong, or they've had it for a really long time, because it's kind of masked by being angry. And then often what they'll do is people will often say, well, I'm angry, but I'm angry because of my job, or I'm angry because of this in my home life isn't right, or it's something else that's happening. And so that masks the problem. Whereas women, because we've been a little bit more socialized that it's okay to share emotions and that's healthy for us, they're more comfortable with talking to friends, and someone may say, you know what, maybe you want to try this or that in order to get help.
You used another term that I just want you to explain to those who may not be clear, and that is passive aggressive. You know, we hear that term really thrown around in society a lot, and I'm just not sure that we're all on the same page in terms of what that actually means. So tell us, what does that actually mean?
So being passive aggressive is almost like, instead of being direct with someone and saying something specifically, so say that you borrowed $20 from me, and instead of me saying, you know what, I see that you've bought a new pair of earrings and I'm upset, you might say passive aggressively, you say, oh, I love the earrings that you bought. You know, oh, you know, nice earrings. And really what I'm saying, I want to say is, you know, you paid for earrings, but you didn't pay me the money that you owe me. So that would be being passive aggressive. Or just being upset, saying, you know, oh, I have to pay for this. You know, I'm losing money a little bit. You know, there's some things that are really upsetting me to that, instead of being direct and saying how we feel. And so being direct would be the opposite, or being angry, just saying, you know what, it bothers me that you bought those earrings and you didn't pay me back the money. I'm upset about that. That would be being direct. So you're not going to actually say what you're really upset about. You're going to take a roundabout way in order to say it without actually wanting to confront someone. And often that happens because you might not feel comfortable with expressing anger, or you might not feel comfortable with the fear that what happens if someone else is upset at me. So you're trying to say, I'm upset about this, without actually saying you're upset about this. But many people don't even read it. They won't even know. And so you're going to feel even more frustrated when someone else brushes it off. You're actually giving someone a pass to not say to someone that this is the way that I like to be treated.
Now, you know that there are folks listening who would say, well, you know, I don't really think that's being passive aggressive. I think that's being polite. I think it's being nice. You're right. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I think that what you want to do is and I think that a lot of people say that, and it's a way so that they're afraid of confrontation. They're afraid of having to say something direct to someone about how they feel. And sometimes it's about feeling weak or being vulnerable or worrying about what they deal with. What I say to that is that we teach people how to treat us. And often the best way to let someone else know, so if you really care about a relationship, you're letting someone know that, you know what, it hurts my feelings or I get upset when this happens. You're actually being kind to them, because rarely do the people in your life ever want to hurt you. But sometimes we don't even let them know how I enjoy being treated. If you tell someone, you know what, it really hurts me when you come in an hour late when we have dinner because I've worked so hard for dinner. That's a very kind thing to do. Yes, it might make them feel a little bad. They might be a little defensive. But at least now they've learned, oh, dinner is very important to them. And you might say the honest truth, if you know it, that might be, you know what, in my family, that was love. Love was coming in, spending this time together, and it means a lot to me. Then someone learns that roadmap of, you know, this is how they like. These are things they like, and that's how they feel loved, and this is what they don't. You do yourself a disservice by saying, you know what, you know, the dinner's already cold, and I left it in the thing, and I ate already. You're angry about it, but you're not letting them know how important it might be to you. And so they're going to keep on perpetuating hurting you. And by the time that you bring it up, or it'll be a blow up, and you're going to say many things that might be hurtful. And they might have never known. Often people say to me also the thought of, but they should just know. They should just know. This is so obvious. They should just know. Rarely do people actually know. We think that everyone kind of goes by the same world rule book. We all have the same rules and things that we go about as good and bad. But we don't. We all have completely different experiences, been raised by different families. And so something that's obvious to you might not be at all obvious to someone else. And so telling someone the way that you feel cared about and things that hurt you is such a nice, kind thing to do so that they won't do it again. And that's really important in close relationships.
So that puts a very different perspective, I think, on the value of being honest about what's going on with you, what works for you and what doesn't. Let me ask you this. We're about to begin to talk about some of the things that one can do on his or her own to really kind of tackle experiences of anxiety. I am wondering, though, if while one is working on this, or even before one starts, if you find that your anxiety is getting in the way of your productivity, do you tell your boss you're dealing with anxiety? Do you tell a colleague, or do you try to keep it to yourself and just fix it?
I think that it depends on your work relationship, and you need to be a little bit aware. I think that almost all bosses and people are very happy and helpful to hear about that you're going through this, and so that they can then manage about how are they going to deal with that, because anxiety is so pervasive. Really, one in three people are going to deal with anxiety in their lifetime for at least a period of time. And so it's something that's very common, and many people can relate to that. There are some bosses that might be more closed-minded to that and upset and don't really care, and it could make you feel even more hurt. But I think that often it can be helpful to let people know. Because if you can say, you know what, I'm having a hard time managing, when you're working more slowly or if you've asked someone else to help you, they're going to be much more able and wanting to do that, because you're not doing it because you're trying to schluff off work. You're doing it because you're having actually a difficulty with that. And so it might be a colleague. It might be your boss at work. It might be your doctor. It could be a friend. It could be, if you are of any religion, it could be one of the, a religious figure that you trust and care about. Say, listen, I'm going through this. How can I manage? And then just by hearing someone else validate and say, you know what? That's okay. I understand. You're okay. Let's get through this. Let's talk about it. Makes you feel so much better because you're not alone. So it would depend on the situation to that. Many of the people that I see have had wonderful experiences in telling the boss or a friend. And for other people, they've handled it fully alone. And that's better for them as well. And there are techniques and tips that you can do just on your own to help manage your anxiety and feel better and healthier.
Well, speaking of techniques and tips, you and your colleague have created a series that it seems like it's really designed to help people who, for whatever reason, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why people might access the information that you and your colleague have put together. But tell me, why did you both decide to create a series for folks on anxiety?
So we created anxiety videos because we said, you know what, we're getting really good at treating anxiety, but there's so many people still suffering. And we went into this field because we really wanted to help people live better lives. And so we said, you know what, a lot of people will never come into our offices, will never go in to see a therapist or someone that they care about, and they're not able to manage it on their own. And we're like, you know what, this is a great service that you can take care of this in the privacy of your own home. You don't have to go out. You don't have to tell anyone. You don't have to experience it with someone else if that is uncomfortable to you. You can go through all the tips and techniques, do it at your own pace, go through it, see what works, see what doesn't work. And for other people, it's for people that are in health fields that want to help people and don't understand maybe everything about what they might be seeing in their offices with people dealing with anxiety. And then there's also family members that are like, my friend or loved one is dealing with anxiety and I want to be able to help them, but I don't know how. And so they go through this and it's a great psychoeducational thing that they can just understand and empathize a little bit more about what will help and what won't. And I think that a lot of people would feel more comfortable treating things on their own or through wonderful shows like yourself and learning about it and taking check of that or through workbooks. And I think that whichever way gets you to living the life you deserve to live, take it. If that works for you, wonderful. And so this was our way of kind of reaching out to many more people than we could ever reach in our offices and be helpful to them as well.
You know, you speaking of a family member who might be dealing with anxiety and you're not quite sure what to do about it, I wonder, I mean, there's so much in the world today that people are very anxious about, but particularly I think about children, whether it's, you know, the latest quote unquote urban legend about the scary clowns, or whether it's not a legend but reality that children get shot in school, they get killed and hurt in school. I mean, there's so many things that children experience. The videos that you're talking about, are they for children or for the parents to share with the children?
So for most of these, they're all deemed at with the parents and how the parents would parent to the children more than the children themselves. So it talks about how should you speak to your child? What if they did hear about, you know, the scary clowns that were through the media for a while, or if their school just had a session of lockdown just in case someone dangerous comes into their school. That can be very frightening for children. And some schools do handle this very well, and some schools don't handle it as well. And it can cause, even if it was handled very well, it can cause a lot of anxiety to a child, especially if your child already is leaning towards being anxious. And so we deal with the way that you speak to them, the way that you can calm them down. Children should only have to handle things that are within their wheelhouse of tools and what to deal with. And so we go through how do you give your children these tools and what are proper boundaries and consequences in your home so that you feel comfortable and happy and everyone feels safe. Because that feeling of safety and I can handle this and things are going to be okay are really strongly linked to our anxiety system.
So if I am a parent with a 12-year-old and let's say an 18-year-old, and they have both heard the latest media explosion about scary things that are happening, whether it's a clown or whether it's, and some of those scary clowns look really scary, whether it's a clown or whether it's a threat or whether it's the anniversary of something, and so it's all in the news media. What do I, as a parent of, let's say a 12-year-old and an 18-year-old, what do I say to my children, and do I say the same things to both?
It would probably be in a little bit of a different vein to that, but pretty close to similar. So the way to go through it is, one, to be honest, and two, to break down what are these urban legends or myths or actually people dressing up, and what is the truth and what isn't the truth. And for chorophobia, which is the fear of clowns, which is quite potent, there's a strong amount of people afraid of clowns for many reasons to that. You can say, yes, you know, clowns are scary. They have exaggerated facial features. You can't read their body language because they're wearing a mask or they're wearing heavy makeup that exaggerates certain features. But you want to be honest, too, is what's really happening is that whenever the media catches hold of something that causes fear and it's a big story and it's something strange, everyone in the media is going to be talking about it. And it's going to be everywhere for a period of time. And you want to be able to also say the stuff that's true in the media versus the stuff that isn't. And for that, you know, a set of websites were actually saying that people actually hurt and they were dangerous and people had been killed from clowns. And none of that was actually true. It was a spoof site. But then a whole bunch of other media sites started reporting on this spoof site. And so you also want your children to be media savvy, understand what they consume, and be able to relate to, is this an exaggeration or does this sound true? In the end, it's a whole bunch of kids that are catching hold of this. They think, and young adults, and they think that it's funny and they want to be part of this movement. And often people carry things that are scary to them and they want to embody it so that they're empowered by that and they're not scared from that. And so it kind of catches hold of itself. And so when they can learn to empathize with, you know, this is just, you know, a teenager, a young adult who thinks that this is funny, and that, you know, it scared a lot of people and people have now been arrested who dress up as clowns and they're put away and they end up with, you know, misdemeanors or not misdemeanors. Some have even had like minor felonies on their system because they just thought that this was funny and it isn't. And to talk about, well, have you ever done anything that you thought would be funny and it wasn't really funny in the end? And then you got in trouble for it and realized, you know what, I really shouldn't have done that. And so once you really break it down into the pieces, it makes it much easier to talk about, and that, you know, they don't have to be worried about this because there isn't actually a danger out there, even if the websites get a lot more clicks by making it seem really ominous and dangerous. But the media often does that anyways. And so we need to be careful about the media that we consume and the manner in which we consume it. You want all of your children to have a critical eye, not just believe what is written or seen, but to think, could this be untrue? Which way are they saying it? And so learning those types of tropes in the media is also a great skill for all parents to give to their kids.
You know, it's interesting because you and your colleague have, I know, created a series of videos to help folks do work at home, if you will, in sort of soothing and healing anxiety themselves. And what is of note to me, at least, is that those videos include a video on parenting. They include a video on boundaries. I mean, so they include they include one on sleep. So it's just interesting all the pieces, all the things that you and your associate have identified as having an impact on anxiety. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to start with just sort of the list of things you and your colleague have identified as having a bearing on anxiety. So we will be back in just a moment. We'll be right back. Georgia, tell us about the various things that, from your perspective, impact one's experience of anxiety.
Well, I think that there's a lot of different things that impact our way that we deal with anxiety. And I think that one that we haven't mentioned is kind of interesting. So it's our own avoidance of things. So whenever we work on something and we're feeling uncomfortable, we often avoid it. We don't like feeling uncomfortable or anxious. And so often we'll avoid the things that make us feel anxious. But once you avoid something, we've actually increased our anxiety towards whatever we have avoided. So avoidance is the best friend of anxiety. So people can catch anxiety right away. If you realize that you're avoiding a person, an interaction, answering the phone, going out, talking to people, whatever it might be, you start avoiding that, you can nip anxiety in the bud right away if you immediately start going towards the things that you fear or that you feel uncomfortable with and talk yourself positively through that. We can not only stop anxiety from starting in the first place, but feel more comfortable in those situations because we're doing them more often. And so you want to watch the things that you avoid. And that would be the same thing that if you are as a parent, you notice that your children are a little bit more shy and uncomfortable. You don't want to just throw them into an uncomfortable situation. You want to slowly let them dip their toes into it. So you want to just gradually let them feel more comfortable as it might be. Maybe paying themselves at a store if they have social anxiety and just saying thank you, and they get their treat. So the excitement of the treat will probably overrun the fear of saying thank you for something at the store, or allowing them to feel comfortable going a little bit further away. A lot of times us as parents, we give our children our anxieties because we're so worried about them, and there's nothing more precious in the world than our children. But often we keep them too close, and we're actually unconsciously telling them the world isn't safe unless you're next to me. And that can also feed an anxiety as well.
For both the parent as well as the child.
Yes.
Now, I notice in the video series that you've put together, at the very beginning of it, you talk about some things that seem so basic. And you talk about, well, you tell us, what do you talk about in the very first video?
Well, you're absolutely right. We start with the basics. So it's food, sleep, and exercise. So these are our building blocks of how we feel healthy. If you're not eating well, then that's sending a signal to your body that there might be something wrong, right? If there's not enough food, food was very important to us. And we often, through our existence, now we have a lot of food if we live in a first world country, but it used to be that food shortages were a huge danger, and that triggers our anxiety system. Our blood sugar levels being even through the day makes us feel calm. Sleep. If you're not sleeping, then your brain doesn't have the time to decode the day and say what's important and what isn't. So sleep is exceptionally important, and we talk a lot about why that is. And we think that it's so important, we actually put one DVD just to sleep, because sleep issues are just such a propensity to people not sleeping well, not understanding what is good sleep hygiene, and even why do we sleep. Many people think that sleep is being lazy. But sleep will make you feel calm and healthy and focused and alert and quick. And so if you think that you're going to win by taking an hour out of your sleep schedule and only getting 6 hours of sleep or 6.5, you're actually going to pay it back later, because the entire day you're going to feel sluggish and not be able to accomplish as much. And so sleep, food, and then exercise, which helps rev you up, get you ready for the day, and actually says to your body, I'm tough and strong, so I don't need to have as much adrenaline in my system, the feeling that we get when we're feeling anxious, because I'm so tough and strong, I can handle this. They're all so good for us. And that sets kind of your foundation for dealing with anxiety. And for some people, that's all they've needed to do, is once they start exercising, even 3 times a week for 15 minutes, for your brain, you don't need to exercise really hard or for very long. Like 15 minutes of calm, relaxed exercise is all you need. But it needs to be a cardio. And they feel so much better. And for some, that's enough management that they need just to get through their anxiety, and they don't need to go any further.
You know, as you talk about this, I mean, in the scheme of things, it sounds so doable and so easy. If for some reason you adjust your sleep, you're paying different attention to your food and your exercise, and you still feel anxious, does that mean you're really sick?
No, it might not be. It really could be that there's another factor. I have some people that exercise a lot, but the factor might be that they're really negative to themselves. As we spoke about beforehand, it could be just you have a very critical, negative, harsh voice. Or it could be that, you know, a lot of people around you are feeding you a lot of negativity and you absorb that. And so it might be that it's just a different area that we need to focus on. And so maybe it would be working on being positive with yourself. And what we call it in psychology is cognitive restructuring, which is a really fancy way for saying just reframing the way that you speak to yourself, speaking to yourself nicer and listening to the things that you say. Maybe that's something that would be your working key to it. Or perhaps it would be a breathing technique. The way that we breathe strongly affects the way that we feel to ourselves. So if we're giving ourselves the message of deep, long breathing, that says, I'm okay. When we're anxious and worried, we do these short chest breaths, which are actually revving us up for running away, which give a forced feedback to our brain of there must be danger, because I'm doing the breathing as if I'm getting ready to run away or to fight something. And so it might be just a different area of anxiety. So don't worry if these are not things that are working for you or that you already do them. It just might be that there's another issue that's the issue that you need to deal with instead.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the value and the power of breathing, and breathing in a way that can actually almost in an instant help you to feel more calm. That almost sounds like magic.
It really does. It really does. And often, it does so much more than just that. So I'll go through why, because a lot of people say, but I breathe already, Georgia. Like, thank you. Like, take your breathing and just, like, stay with it. But really what happens is, and I get that. I do actually understand. It seems, like, too simple to even work. But what happens is this. So when we're worried, our brain says to ourselves, that part of our brain called the amygdala sends out a signal saying, you know what, I'm not sure if everything's okay. Do a body check and see if everything's all right. And it checks our blood pressure, our levels of breathing. And it says to ourselves, am I okay or am I not okay? And so what you want to do is you want to send yourself a different message. And so what you do is by doing the deep, long, calm breathing, when the part of our brain called the amygdala says, I don't know if everything's okay, do a body check. And you start doing long, deep, relaxed breathing, right? The most relaxed we can be is when we're asleep. And that is long, deep baby breaths, right? These really deep belly breathing that we do when we're sleeping. We start doing those breathing, our body says, oh, you're doing long, deep breaths. I guess everything must be okay. You mustn't be running from a tiger or another danger because you're doing this breathing. I'm going to wait before I send the epinephrine and cortisol and all of those anxiety neurotransmitters that we end up sending to ourselves and hormones. I'm going to hold off on those for a little bit. I'm going to check in again. And if you're still doing that deep breathing, we're saying, you know what? Everything's okay. I can handle this. And so you're giving yourself with that. And if you add to it that the cognitive part, thoughts are, I'm okay, I can handle this, I've handled worse in a year, I'm not even going to think about this. Then your body says, oh, I guess it's okay. I don't need to send the adrenaline into your system. You'll be fine. And so by and of itself, doing the deep breathing allows your body to feel calm and safe. And you get an added bonus. When we're really calm, is when our body heals, period. When we're anxious and upset, our body sends a whole bunch of red blood cells to help feed our body, feed our muscles. We burn through our sugar. We send out cortisol. And when we're calm and relaxed, that's when our body says, oh, there's no danger. It's time to do repairs. So it also makes you more healthy and focused. So it's really, really good for you. And it's something that I ask people to do, like, just 2 minutes a day. That's it. 2 minutes a day. But I do ask them to split it up through the day. So maybe, you know, a few breaths, 8 times a day, like 10 seconds of deep breathing, just so that this becomes what we call muscle memory. Your body innately knows how to do it. And if you see someone anxious, you'll often see them do that big breath.
Right.
That's actually them trying to re-regulate their breathing. This is so much better for that. And so if you see someone doing it, just deep in And then the only thing you need to know if you want to learn how to do a breathing technique really, really quick is you say slower and deep. And however long you breathe in, you want to breathe longer out. You breathe into your nose, the natural regulator, and out through your mouth. And however long you've breathed in for, breathe out for longer. And slow it down a little more each breath. And that's it. There's a lot of people that find breathing also, it's too mechanical and it makes them more anxious than you don't have to think of anything, but slow it down. Whatever you breathe in for, breathe out for longer and try to slow it. And that'll work for you too.
So far, what you've talked about is things that, in the scheme of things, aren't really that scary. You want folks to eat more healthily, exercise, engage in useful sleep hygiene, slow down their breathing. I mean, these are things that don't particularly scare people. But then you also talk in the videos about the importance of looking at your past. And that's enough to send a lot of people completely over the edge. They're not thinking about their past for any reason whatsoever.
Well, the thing is that if you don't know of your past, so there's some things that just doing regular, simple, straightforward cognitive behavioral techniques will work for. You can just look at the forward and just deal with that. And that's kind of the Band-Aid effect. And for some people, that's all they need to do. Just doing exercise might be what they need to lower their levels of anxiety. But sometimes there's also wounds that we have inside of us, something that's hurt us deeply that's happened in our past. And we've tried to just box that into a cupboard and never look at that. And the thing is that if there's something that keeps on reoccurring to you, a pattern that you're reliving, something that's happening over and over again, or something that hurts you deeply and you've never been able to fix it, it's probably linked to something in your past that's there. And that's a wound. Now, dealing with something that's hurt you in the past, yes, it can be very uncomfortable. It's something that is very painful and you don't want to relive it. But if you go back to it, and in proper techniques, and for this, often I do say, if it's something that's too hard for you, you might want to do this with, say, a therapist or someone that you feel comfortable with, or through, you know, reading and technique. This might be a little bit more painful, or just in little tiny pieces at a time, the ones that are manageable to you. So that might be a wound that you've had from your childhood or from your past. And often there's some piece to that that needs to be healed in order for you to feel light and to be able to move on. And I've had people that have come in with very strong anxiety and very strong depression. And they've been to many therapists and they've never delved into the past. And for some people, maybe even the therapist didn't feel comfortable delving into the past. It may not be their skill set. And that in and of itself, going back through it, decompiling it, going through the feelings. Are you feeling guilty? Are you being hard on yourself? Is it traumatic? And reframing it and really talking about that was the key to making themselves be calm and happy and be able to go forward. So I look at it as almost like carrying rocks in your backpack. We all carry rocks in our backpack that kind of heavy our trek uphill. And by going through and looking at your past and issues that you might have there, it's like taking a rock out of your backpack and being able to leave it on the road. It's still there. You know of it. You can acknowledge it. It's not like it's going to go away or that you're going to forget. But it's light enough now that you can take it out of your backpack, leave it on the road, validate that it's there, and then move on with your life without all the baggage that that piece might have had and hurt and pain from that experience. And that can be a wonderful experience for people, but also I fully understand that it can also be feel scary and overwhelming. So there is a way to do that so that it's healing and makes you feel safe.
We've been talking about the emotional impact of anxiety. Are there physical impacts? Is there a physical fallout from being chronically anxious?
Oh, there are so many to them. The way that we feel and our emotions do have a symptom to each other. And so the first one is just, how do you feel when you're anxious? And so some people feel dizzy, lightheaded. They might not be able to think. When we're really anxious, our limbic system, the part of our brain that deals with anxiety, our fight or flight system, will actually knock out our working memory. And so the analytical part of our brain, the brain part of the brain that thinks and we're so proud of and can calculate and analyze things, actually becomes numbed. And so that's why when you're really anxious, it might be hard to do that test or to answer that question in that job interview or to be able to do that presentation, because part of your working memory is kind of knocked out for that period of time. And that can be very distressing to people. And you might feel tightness in chest, difficulty breathing. And then if you're chronically having anxiety, you may also be higher, there's a greater chance of getting sick because your body isn't in that healing period. And so you might end up with, you know, greater chances of heart disease and diabetes and having a heart attack. And there's a lot of things that actually happen physically. It's not just the thing that we're dealing with, the emotion in the brain, but our entire body reacts very strongly to feeling anxious and the threat of danger. And for some people, they're anxious so much that they don't even feeling calm gives them a panic attack, because they might say that when I'm feeling calm, I feel like there's something bad that could happen to me. Often we're listening, our anxiety system is there to tell us a message, to say there's something that's not right in our world. And he wants us to change it. We're often not able to or don't have the tools to be able to make that happen. But it affects everything in us. Even our nail growth, our skin healing, our hair growth. People can lose their hair because of anxiety. Their skin won't heal as well. They might end up with patchiness in their skin from that. It really affects every part of our life, our love life, our interrelationships, our feeling of being in comfort. Everything is affected by anxiety. And so it's something that we need to be able to speak out about, talk about, and really this should be something that was taught in our school system to children. Because if this was taught when we were young, this was tools that we gave our kids right away, then they wouldn't have to deal with this. Because the longer that you have anxiety, the harder it is to kind of get past it, because you've created a pathway that's very strong in your brain of anxiety. You've mastered anxiety, which is probably something you do not want to master.
Exactly. You know, Georgia, we have been talking and you've been giving us such great advice, but clearly there's so much more to learn about it. As we close out our conversation today, is there a website or a place that folks can go to get more information about everything that you've been sharing with us today?
Yes, there is. You can head down to anxiety-videos.com. And you can check out all the different information if you want to learn more.
That's terrific. And again, that's anxietyvideos.com?
Yes, it's anxiety with a dash in between. We couldn't get anxietyvideos.com. Okay. So we had to put a dash in between it.
Gotcha.
But just think about dashing down to anxietyvideos.
The world of technology. Georgia Dow, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing so much information about anxiety, and clearly letting us know that there's so much that we can do ourselves in dealing with anxiety. Georgia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was absolutely delightful.
Wonderful. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is available to you daily as an educational public service. You can always go to mindtalk.org, mindtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from iTunes. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And remember, Mind Talk is about education information. We do not intend for you to use anything that you learn as a replacement for work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And you remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, then it's just unacceptable. You take care.